Thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium session 251. Title of the session is Why I Stay. And our guests today are Caleb Jones, Julie D'Azevedo, and Farina King. And if you guys want to go ahead and join us with video and audio, please do that right now so everybody can see you while I give instructions. Let's see. Each year, the Sunstone Education Foundation has carried on a brilliant tradition in partnership with longtime Sunstoner and former Sunstone editor Dan Witherspoon to bring a panel together of dedicated Mormons to discuss why and how they engage their religious tradition. And Dan wasn't able to host the session this year, and so I am taking his place. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. Give me one second. I'm going to see if I can get our presenters in here. Okay, here we go. Hold on, Julie. There we go. Julie should be able to join us now. There we go. Now you can see everybody. Give them a wave. Say, everybody say hi.
Hello.
Okay. Let's see. Here's some Q&A instructions for all of you who are watching on the app. Just because of the way the technology works, the presenters can't see you and you aren't able to ask live questions, but you can submit questions through the app. And then I, as the moderator, will go through the questions and during their presentations, I'll get those ready. And then during the Q&A time, I'll ask those questions on your behalf. So submit your questions there. If you have a question that's specifically for one of the presenters, then you should indicate that in your question. Otherwise, we'll assume that the question is the general question for anyone on the panel. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Now, about this presentation, this is perennially a very well-received session, and it features stories of those who have chosen to remain active, dedicated Latter-day Saints, even in the face of challenges to traditional faith. Let me take a second to just read some short bios of our participants today. First, we have Farina King. Now, if you look at the post about this, you will see Farina's Navajo name, and maybe when it's your turn, you can pronounce that for us. Actually, I need to tell you, I have a very good friend who is native Navajo, and I called him and I said, I want you to teach me how to say this so that I can be awesome, and I couldn't do it. He coached me and he sent me a recording and I practiced for 2 days and I just couldn't do it. And I thought it would be more respectful to not. So there you go. Farina King, a citizen of the Navajo Nation, is assistant professor of history and affiliated faculty of Cherokee and Indigenous Studies at Northeastern State University, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Side note, my brother taught there for about 9 years. In the biology department. He said you moved into his ward the same week they were moving out. So you probably don't know. But anyway, you and I are connected through Tahlequah. Go to Fish's Barbecue if you haven't already. It's very good. She received her PhD at Arizona State University in U.S. history. She specializes in 20th century Native American studies. She is the author of The Earth Memory Compass, Dene Landscapes and Education in the 20th Century. So that's Farina. Next we have Caleb Jones. Caleb Jones describes himself as a post-secular Mormon who practices in the LDS Church. He lives in the Pacific Northwest with his wife and four children, where he and his wife have co-founded an LGBTQ plus FHE with their stake. He serves on the board of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, has spent years moderating online resources for those struggling with faith, and co-authors the blog NavigatingDiscipleship.com with his wife. My connection to Caleb, I don't know him, I haven't met him personally until today, but is that he contributes and posts frequently on the Waters of Mormon discussion group on Facebook. And I joined that group in November 2015. I was serving as a bishop when the policies were announced in November 2015, and I was looking for resources, not just for the people in my ward, but for myself to sort of figure out how to navigate through that. And I've appreciated very much, Caleb, what you've had to say on there, and I've benefited personally from it. Finally, we have Julie D. Azevedo Hanks, PhD, LCSW, is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist with 28 years experience specializing in women's emotional health and relationships. She is an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University. Dr. Hanks is the founder and director of Wasatch Family Therapy, an outpatient therapy clinic in Cottonwood Heights and Bountiful, Utah. She is author of The Burnout Cure and The Assertiveness Guide for Women. She is a blogger, a local and national media contributor, an online influencer, a private practice consultant, and an award-winning performing songwriter. And this is how I know Julie, because I used to work at Excel Entertainment Group, which was a group of record labels and a distribution company, and Julie was one of the recording artists. So we worked very closely together on some projects. Julie's one of my all-time favorite people. Julie is a native California. She currently lives in Sandy, Utah. For additional resources, visit drjuliehanks.com or connect with at Dr. Julie Hanks, that's Dr. Julie Hanks, on social media. So we will go in the order that I introduced you. Just, I forgot to tell the presenters this, but we'll turn it over to Farina. Farina, when you're done, you just end, and then I'll come on, and then I will sort of hand it off to the next person, just so you know how that's going to go. And then, so it'll be Farina, and then Caleb, and then Julie. And then when Julie's session is over, we'll bring everybody back on screen, and we'll do our Q&As. So let's get Farina all on her own here. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'm gonna start with sharing my screen because I have some images I'd like to share with you all. And it pulls up my, jump there. Thanks for bearing with me. Where did my Google Chrome go? Okay, here we go. Thank you so much for that introduction and for inviting me. I must admit this is my first time of participating in a session like this. So I'm also going to try to watch time. I can easily talk a lot. When being asked to join this group, I think a lot about terms as a scholar and even the way we introduce ourselves and how we identify, those are questions that I ask constantly. And I know we all do to some extent, but it's the kinds of questions that I've dedicated my life to studying and exploring and having daily conversations, almost on a daily level, these kind of conversations with the work that I do. With this very question of why I stay, it reminded me of more the kind of why I believe firesides that I would hear about when I lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and they have a Washington, D.C. Visitor Center. Because, of course, I have been asked this question point blank of how can you be involved with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? How can you participate in it? How can you believe in such and such? But, you know, on the other end, the other extreme, people would ask, how can you ever question? How can you ever doubt? Why would you ever leave? You know, so I think it's important to think about that spectrum as well. So something, a term that I want to introduce us from the beginning here too, when we think about languages and the terms that we're working through as we're having these kind of dialogues, even if I'm speaking right now at you, I really hope to hear feedback from you. And I look forward to the conversation with these other incredible panelists and all these ongoing conversations happening this weekend with Sunstone and other related affiliated groups that you might have on your own, smaller groups. And it's just remarkable, the kind of ongoing conversations. But what are our common grounds? How do we relate? How do we discuss this? And this is very important to that very question I asked you. If someone asked you, why do you stay versus why would you leave? You know, already there's implications in the terms. There's the baggage, the connotations, and what they spark in us. So even when we're thinking about religion and faith, and a person's positionality, my own in this case that I'm speaking about, that I am speaking from a very unique perspective, but one that I hope resonates and connects with each of you, no matter who you are, where you come from, and how you relate to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But I wanted to introduce you to a term that I learned later, more as an adult, is sodizin, dosin. Which is a Navajo way that's being applied. It's not perfectly translatable, but one that refers to faith and now religion. But for Navajos, they never had a word for religion, right? There wasn't this idea that this is religion, this is the state, or this is our life outside of religion or whatever. No, it's all holistic. It's all together. Religion, at least the ways that we are wrapping our heads around it, trying to think about it. It's a way of life. We're talking about ways of life and ways of being. So that's something that has resonated with me as I thought about that, learning that my ancestors, my grandparents, and my father, the way he was raised, that religion, you know, it, even that concept is new, like this idea of religion, that there's a church you go to on Sunday and maybe your other parts of your life can be walled or categorized or differ in various ways. But no, being Navajo, it was like, that's your religion, being Navajo, being Diné. So I am going to explain, take you on a little bit of my journey in this quick time we have together, but I like I said, hope we can continue these conversations, is I was born in Navajo Nation, and the way that we introduce ourselves, it's not necessarily our name, even though our clans, that's a traditional way Navajos introduce ourselves, because we that's a part of being Navajo as well, is your family, where you come from. Not just in the sense of like a country, but physically the land we come from. And this is something I also like to share with whoever I talk to, is a Navajo ancestral way that we ask people where you're from are, where are your umbilical cords buried? Hadish nitzeh, because when a baby was born, the umbilical cord would be buried in a place that you wanted your child to always gravitate to, that there would always be an ongoing connection with your child in that place. And that also was an important part of being Diné. And so Diné families might bury their child's umbilical cord by the corral if they want them to be close to the livestock, or by the hogan, the home site in the traditional place. As I started to, I was starting to explore and understand what it means to be Latter-day Saint and Diné, that's been an overarching journey in my life, because I was born into a practicing Latter-day Saint family, but two parents who met at Brigham Young University, they were converts to the church, and my father from the Navajo Nation and my mother from Michigan of white settler descent. And this is where we say, you know, first our clans, She'e Bilagana Nishle, Do Kia Ani Bashish Ching, Bilagana Dashache, Do Sinijani Dashanale, Akot Egoatsa Nishle. And I just said, basically my family history. You know, if you think about a lot of these Latter-day Saint teachings, there's correlations. And for me, I've always been impressed by how Latter-day Saints, you know, we emphasize that families can be together forever and push genealogy and family history. Well, Navajos, our ancestors have always emphasized that. That's central to who we are. We basically are introducing ourselves through our family history every time we meet. And that way we also recognize the responsibilities and obligations we have for each other. Ironically though, it was, well, or maybe not so ironic, but it was my elders, my uncle in particular, who really took me under his wing and was sure that I knew my clans, because our tribal nation and our people were very matrilineal, and you learn a lot from the mother. The mother sings to you as soon as you're in the womb of your clans, of who you are, of Diné ancestral teachings. But my mother, you know, is of European American descent, and so I say I'm Bilagana. But I'm born for my father's people, which are the Towering House Clan and the Blackstreet Woods people. And so again, there's this emphasis, right? This comes out in a lot of my research in the Earth Memory Compass and a lot of my studies of how important places and knowing where we're from and how that shapes us as well. That's integral to who we are. That's where this idea as well with where's your umbilical cord and what will you gravitate to? When I was doing research with my Navajo communities, that was something my dad told them in Navajo to help them understand why I'm being so drawn to my people and working with them, is he would say her umbilical cords are buried here. So she'll always have that connection. And interestingly too, as I started to explore more of other Latter-day Saint, Native American, and especially Navajo experiences in the church, I did over dozens, around 100 interviews, but you know, a lot of interpersonal experiences too with friends. That's my community, special Native American congregations that I've connected with. I remember interviewing a woman who mentioned that she buried her grandchild's umbilical cord on temple grounds of a Latter-day Saint temple, and she always wanted her child to be drawn to that. So as I said earlier, to also emphasize is, my father, his journey of conversion has been really a big influence on me. Of course, both my parents, my mother was home with us. My dad, he went on to become a physician, and I write about that recently in a piece for the Center for Latter-day Saint Arts, Diné Doctor, that my dad, He has a very long journey and incredible story that has strongly influenced my own. But basically, to not go off too much on a tangent there, but to not understate its emphasis in my own journey, is my dad, he was able to learn about the church in high school and decide to go to Brigham Young University before joining the church. And then he had a terrible falling out with his own father, who was a medicine man, Hatafle, and because he decided to join the church while at BYU. And then he went on a mission and was called to the Southwest Indian Mission. And this is a picture of my father. And this term as well, that Mormons or Latter-day Saints are called among Navajos, Gamali. And I'm still trying to figure out what exactly that term means. Some joke, it means they talk too much, or other different ideas of all these terms have a lot of embeddedness and layers to them. But No one really has a definitive answer about that. So my father went on the Southwest Indian mission. Right before his mission, his mother, she, of course, was always supportive of him and his choices, but his father said, never come home, you know, never return. You're basically out of my life. And my dad shared that testimony at the pulpit several times, and it resonated with me of, I always wanted to know and understand with both of my parents, not just my father, but both of my parents, why would they decide to be a part of this church when they didn't have to? And when actually it had a lot of costs for them and even pain. And I don't know, you know, just in my experience of meeting a lot of other different Latter-day Saints, I don't know if they also face those same questions, and maybe, you know, you do. And I love learning from that. But for me, being a Latter-day Saint, I wasn't in a heavy Latter-day Saint community. It's like it was another way of being othered, actually. And in terms of intersectionality, all these layers of identities that I was already dealing with as a child of mixed ancestry, you know, being in a liminal space there of not being, you know, fully identified as white, even if I'm white passing, but not ever being fully identified as Diné or Navajo, and then being Diné of a people who have been historically marginalized and traumatized through outright, you know, targets for extermination through settler colonialism that I explore in my studies of Native American and Indigenous peoples, and going even into, you know, more recent histories, right? This isn't so long ago as people wanna push it. And including, you know, learning about Mormon settlers and settlers from the church who also were entangled with massacres and violent episodes and disposal and removal, right? That wherever we are, especially in the United States, or you can ask anywhere really in the world, who are the peoples who have shaped those spaces, whether you're conscious of it or not? And even if we say, well, that wasn't me, the histories of settler colonialism, that I'm not accountable for these actions that came before me, are we, in what ways, how are we responsible for ongoing legacies and perpetuation of that settler colonialism and such? So these are questions that, even from a young age, I was already facing, even meeting people as I've lived in a lot of different places on and off of Navajo Nation, but mostly away from Navajo Nation and away from what folks identify as heavy, a high population of Mormons and Mormon corridors. So it just was another way of me being weird, that Farina was this Latter-day Saint, Native American of mixed ancestry. And, you know, I always knew that I had a choice of what self I would pursue, what kind of person I would become. And so that for me was a powerful part of that journey. Let me see if I can move to the next one. So a term that has helped me, I think, to come to peace with who I am and how I'm identifying as this person navigating multiple worlds, right? Because I am one person, but we all have different facets of ourself, different maybe communities and circles that we're a part of, and they can overlap or they can clash even. They can have tensions. And that's what I find when most people, when they ask me that question, why do you stay? That I'm being asked today with this is it's especially because I am Native American, because I am Diné, and they know about the histories of the Indian placement program and how there were cases of abuse and child abuse, or things that Brigham Young said about race and curses and Lamanites, and how they've been the term has been appropriated or interpreted as evil or dark, right? So they have all these examples of wrongs, you know, being done or some distorted teachings, right? Or whatever, or how people have used it to hurt other people. And they're asking me, how can you stay? Especially as a Diné woman and one who knows and is a scholar, learning and understanding these very, what I find, complicated histories and ongoing presence. And this quote from Wilson Aranith, I think of it as a guiding star that since I've thought about this overarching, it's explaining really and referring to this overarching Diné teaching, one that goes, you know, connects to time immemorial for our people and our ancestors, and one that my grandfather, my Nalis, you know, all my ancestors that they think about. Sa Nagai, Bik'e Hajo. And maybe you might have heard of a basic translation of Navajo prayers and ceremonies known as Walk in Beauty. But this isn't something we can easily translate. It's not translatable in many ways. But if we attempt in this forum, you know, to understand it, it means to live a long life, walking, you know, on the journey of life, a long life in beauty. And that beauty, hajo, is not a superficial beauty, but it's harmony and it's balance, right? And life is about, as my father explained to me and many of the elders in my life have exemplified to me, life is about these constant twists and turns of the twists and turns that we face in life of constant imbalances and constant upheavals and challenges and sickness and, you know, the vices of life, like the woes of humanity that we're facing in mortality. And we're going to constantly face that as we're walking a journey, a cyclical journey. But what is our compass, right? And this is something that I explore in my writing for an academic audience, but it's also a layered audience too, for my own community and talking with them and Navajos of the present and even the future. As I think about people and lives and lived experiences through all time, it reminds me so much of even just our Come Follow Me lessons this week as we're preparing for Sunday in Alma, chapter 40, I believe, where he talks about what will be restored. Because also in Navajo teachings, and I would fathom, I mean, I'm less familiar with a lot of other teachings of the world, but it's a kind of teaching that transcends even a group or even a faith, and that pursuit of truth and the pursuit of a good life, of happiness that everyone seeks. And we find it in different ways and wherever we're born or how we're placed or what we're facing. And for me, it comes through the teachings of Sa Nagai Bik'e Hajon and my readings and learning in the church and through, you know, engaging with materials like Come Follow Me and the Book of Mormon. And so when I read Alma 40 today and went over scriptures from lessons from Alma 39 to 42 that are coming up for this Sunday, this Sabbath, that language of restoration and the conversation about the tension and sifting through, trying to understand and the judgment of the Lord and justice, God's justice, and mercy. It gives me a lot of peace that a person will be restored for the good works in their life, and they will have to face the Lord's judgment for the poor works, you know, the bad works or whatever. And I hate, you know, in our mortality, we're dichotomizing a lot, bad and good, but it's complicated, and I'm not saying or justifying that there's wrong, that there's no wrong, right? I believe in universal truth, that there is truth out there. And there's that revelation and the ways that we can know what's wrong and right. And for me, it just hit me so hard today, the impression of how even when I find that those who have been portrayed as heroes or those we turn or places we turn for truth, my foundation, as I've learned from my parents and those who, not just my parents, you know, it's not like I agree with everything they say, but also those who have been examples for me, is that we're all going to make mistakes. And if we even look at ourselves and see how we're making mistakes, what's the path of seeking our balance, of seeking our hajot, of seeking that beauty and life and happiness? And what's our compass to get there? And in the Book of Mormon, it teaches us of repentance and of Jesus Christ as a key part of reorienting yourself and getting, you know, back on track of where you need to be, though it is still a painful process. You know, when we're going to go astray and make mistakes. And I think even with all the current debates about memorialization, public memory, you know, Columbus and heroes and Brigham Young and how people how different people understand it. It for me, I'm trying to understand people of different time of the past and seeking to have empathy and sympathize, but also to be careful of recognizing, you know, as in these scriptures of Alma that I was reading, when there is fault, and to come to the dust in humility, right? That also stood out to me, is being humble and being able to recognize when we make mistakes and to, again, restore balance. So that's what I want to leave you all with, that's helped me to find and seek balance in my life. As I'm still evolving, I'm still becoming, we all are, we're learning to be the best us. In this life, you know, people call that perfection, but it's a becoming. But I do believe and see everyone as a child of God, as my brothers and sisters, whoever they are. And I'm so grateful for those powerful truths, that we're going to hear some opinion and some interpretations mixed with truth. And that's a part of the challenge of seeking the balance and seeking discernment, prayer, and the connection with those who truly know, as our Heavenly Father does. And I'm grateful, you know, to share this with you, and thank you for listening to me. And I hope you all well and be well wherever you are during this time of COVID-19. I think it helps us to especially think about what we need for our healing, not just in the physical sense, but spiritual, that we're all healing to really seek that the golden standards of love one another, be like Christ and what Christ would do, and he loves all of us, and he wants us all to be together as a family. Thank you
so much. As a reminder to those of you who are watching, if you have questions, you can submit them via Whova. And if you have specific questions for Farina or Julie or Caleb, please make sure you say that in the notes. Let's go ahead and turn it over to Caleb Jones.
All right. Thank you so much, Farina. That was great. Really appreciated a lot of that wisdom you shared with us. This question of why I stay, this was an interesting exercise, and I'm really grateful for the invitation and opportunity to share some of my thoughts. It's an interesting exercise because it asks a lot of you to really dig deep and ask, what are these reasons? And how does this interplay with my identity? And how does this all come together for what path I choose and in what way? So, the question why in this session is really interesting, because why is one of those questions that's paradoxically necessary to ask, but also simultaneously too psychologically expensive to ask all the time. And so digging deep here, we have to be careful we don't get stuck in paralysis. My own personal opinion is that humanity really walks this delicate line between asking these hard why questions and moving forward in the unknown, in situations where we don't have all the right answers. We don't have our path fully set out for us. And so this why, this almost existential why is a really interesting challenge. And I encourage a lot of people to take this exercise themselves. For myself, I took this as a writing exercise. And so I'll be reading a lot of this. But really, I wanted to do two things with this. One is frame it in terms of my own personal journey, which I think is, you know, what this session is very much about, but also talk a little bit about how I situate myself in the larger context of the things that I see going on in religion today. Because we all, as Farina mentioned, we all come from places in time and inherit things, and how we grapple with that is very much part of why we choose to walk the paths that we do. Let me share quickly before I get too much into that. Let me share this, because I put some images together. This hymn, and this goes to a personal story I'll kind of start out with, the LDS hymn, Come Follow Me, touches, I think, on this tension. And I wanted to read just a bit of it here, this tension between knowing and acting. It says, is it enough alone to know that we must follow him below while traveling through this veil of tears? No, this extends to holier spheres. We must on the onward path pursue a wider, as wider fields expand to view, and follow him unceasingly, whatever our lot or sphere may be. So in early 2018, in January, I think it was the very first, it was a fast testimony meeting, I sang this opening song at the beginning of that ritual, right, where we share our faith, hope, and knowledge with that ever-present phrase, I know. And it caught me odd that we would sing a song about how spiritual knowledge is not enough before that ritual. And so I got up and asked, what does that hymn mean, that it's not enough alone to know? And I spoke about how we need that courage to act as we respond to one another in this veil of tears. And that was particularly stood out to me because of a previous experience I had just weeks before that. So this is going back to 2017 in Christmas. After the typical Christmas Day festivities, I was on the phone with my brother, and I could tell in his voice that he was not doing well. Just weeks after my father had passed away due to cancer, my mother was spending Christmas with my brother and his family in California, and she suddenly suffered some kind of cardiac episode. They were able to ambulate her to a nearby hospital where she laid intubated in the ICU. She was stable, barely, and my brother and his wife spent the last 24 hours in the ICU with her. I booked a flight right away to be there the next day until she could get onto some kind of a path to recovery. Things were a bit of a blur. My mother was tired, wondering if she was being called to be back with Dad. Honestly, we were wondering that too. Communicating was difficult, with thumbs up and down and words shakily drawn on a finger and iPad. Doctors coming and going, decisions, surgeries, contingencies, what ifs, no guarantees, sleepless nights, so forth. When we understood how serious the longer term circumstances were going to be, my aunt volunteered to come down and help. I love my aunt. She has a kind of no nonsense grit and determination as her gift. Whether she's ministering to seniors in a long term care facility or going toe to toe with priesthood to leadership to tell them they're wrong for postponing a baptism because of a previously scheduled basketball pickup game, her stories of fearlessness are wonderful. I often think of that verse in the Book of Mormon, says, "If all men had been and were and ever would be," and I liken it to her. If all women were and had been and ever would be like unto her, the powers of hell would be shaken forever. She was a godsend in that difficult time, and to help my mother have courage to further stabilize. So in those long, nervous hours of silence felt in hospitals, she and I took the time to catch up and reflect on the situation. My father's death is still really fresh in our minds. the questions of what does this mean and why did this happen came up. My aunt saw divine providence and cause and meaning around this. I saw mostly random, unfortunate biological circumstance. Don't get me wrong. I believe we can create and find deep meaning and in our experiences that draw us to God. But my Mormonism has changed such that I do not find comfort in a God that's behind everything. We discussed this, her and I, and we didn't find much common ground. Further discussion, questions of ultimate salvation came up. Again, there were strong differences of opinion. And I believe in a early Mormon model of eternal progression that extends well beyond this life and between kingdoms. And I think that if intelligence exists, it's capable of growth, almost by definition, and that removing that ability for growth would make it not even intelligence anymore. I don't even know what that would be. And she felt pretty different with more rigid kind of strict stratification is what is pretty common. And so again, not much common ground here. So I think this experience that I had, this eroding common ground gets at the heart of what's going on in my opinion in religion in today and some of the crisis that it faces. It's often seen clearly in generational shifts with tension and tradition. I think in a way, over-reliance on tradition is like gerrymandering the districts of time, use that kind of metaphor. It consolidates power, but often at the cost of the voice of those it governs. While tradition can stabilize, it has that that wisdom that it can bring with it. Each new generation has to face it almost like manna. It can spoil after time and they need to go out and gather it up anew. I think of the great prince when he noted that not a single significant LDS doctrine has gone unchanged through the entire history of the church. And I think that's true. It's very much in process. And there are real risks involved here as the doctrines of one era can become the polemics of another. These are some of the things that kind of swirl around in my head when I think about why stay. So while this essay is about my own experience, the second thing I want to bring up here is the larger currents that are going on inside of religion. The between 2015 Pew surveys that talk about the rise of the nuns, religious affiliation rates significantly shifting, even as late as last year, finding these trends that, since 2015 are continuing straight through into our time today. Jana Reese has done a lot of work here as well, finding growing cohorts of young Mormons for who the traditions of Mormonism have instead almost become like an anathema. For many, that comfort of correlation has multiplied into a crushing weight of conformity or strict standards of safety of birth, the culture of judgment. Truth claims can sometimes form into a contentious wedge within families and communities. Veneration of leaders can turn into idol worship. And centrality of post-World War II nuclear family can define a capricious periphery. And so I think we need to be careful because a lot of these things that, again, traditions that we've held wisdom on are starting to become this almost like spoiled manna. And we need to think through what and how and why are we going to carry forward in faith. So I've seen this in my own family. When our son came out as gay over a year ago, when he came out, he framed it by saying, "I don't think I can be Mormon because I don't want to be alone." The irony and tragedy of that statement, given Mormonism's strong emphasis on relationships, is deafening. I describe it almost as it creates a ringing in the soul. So it causes me to think of how could we deny that most basic desire for loving companionship to God's children? For my own family, for myself, I take a posture of equanimity. I was not asked or denied loving companionship, and so I won't do so for my own children. I would likely maybe make the same assessment. And so we've chosen to very much support him in his spiritual journey while trying to restore the good that he can find in whatever way. This puts me a bit at the edge of prevailing LDS doctrines and norms, but I wonder, how could I be anywhere else but an edge when the center pole struggles to accept my own flesh and blood? This kind of displacement creates kind of, like rangers or explorers between religious borders. Well, I don't want to trivialize the subject nor dwell on it too long for the purposes of this essay. I do find it useful to look at one salient fact as it relates to LGBTQ individuals. And that fact is that there's no policy or program, handbook, ceremony, prayer, revelation, proclamation, authority, priesthood. We can go on and on, briefs and anointings and vestments and firesides, whatever instrument we want to pick. None of those can change the fact that about 5%, likely more, of God's children born into LDS families will be LGBTQ. Nothing at church, its culture, resources can do can stop this. But this, in my opinion, is part of the revelation. Our heavenly parents seem intent on sending to us their beloved LGBTQ children. That is significant. I wonder, perhaps our parents have wisely placed their will on the matter within their LGBTQ children, requiring us to first listen to and honor them before we can receive it, much like how Jesus's parables require a broken heart or contrite spirit to understand. I do not know of any group that has done more earnest soul-searching, asking, knocking, and wrestling with God on the topic of gender and sexuality than God's LGBTQ children. With the diversity of God's children, it's often maybe not a question of us receiving revelation for others, but a question of whether we can hear the revelation coming through others. Our heavenly parents have sent the rain of their LGBTQ children on the just and unjust. I say, let us be just. So that's just one issue that I wanted to go into with a lot of specifics on the complexities involved in this question of why stay. And wading through this, there's multiple layers here. Why stay religious? Why stay Mormon? And why stay in the LDS church? And there are various issues at those layers: treatment of women, treatment of children, treatment of people of color, origin of scripture, white supremacy, church organization and wealth and nature of covenants, obedience culture. We could go on and on. But these all present complex, sometimes paradoxical questions that get at this question of why stay. And so that first layer of why stay is why stay religious. So I don't think one avoids a lot of these challenges that can have their own unique flavor and flair in Mormonism and the LDS Church simply by leaving. I think life presents these challenges to us in a very human way, in regardless of any group, ideology, or institution. As the experience of current events have shown that we're living through today, confronting our collective culpability is disorienting. It's painful, unpredictable. It's existential work, but it's also necessary at all levels of human society. And since it is predictable or unpredictable, neither I nor anyone else can predict the results. I can't give anyone else the reason to stay. These are all my own deep personal reasons. And it's not a question of finding the right equation either. I don't think that we can find one formula and say, there it is. Everyone just needs to get on board. So these are very much personal journeys that we're on. I think that faith and worship, it's an ongoing conversation as well. And it's a conversation that we need to visit and revisit and discuss with one another. I think this will be a very healthy topic to bring up in church settings even, and say, these are reasons why I stay, but at the same time, these are the griefs that I have sometimes. And this is why it can be also be difficult and why I need support. For me personally, on my own journey, I've had to go through a process of deconstruction. And in my introduction, it was mentioned that I identify as a post-secular Mormon, so you'll have to excuse me. This is where I get a little bit technical or nerdy, you might say. But at base, when I go through deconstruction, or I've gone through deconstruction process, I come away with these kind of core axioms, that God is bigger than church, truth is bigger than church, morality is bigger than church. And the implications of these can be pretty far-reaching. If we reduce our answers to these big questions of life to just church or its dogmas, then I don't think our answers will be big enough. They'll always be too parochial, too defensive, and too susceptible to confirmation bias. It puts faith in church above faith in God, right? And so I think we need to set these priorities straight. It also sets us up so that every flaw in church, big or small, or flaw in community, big or small, is poised to create an existential crisis of faith. If we instead choose to see things as bigger than church, we can frame our relationship and participation in and fallen nature with church and make appropriate expectations and boundaries. So I think that's an important process to go through in deconstruction, find how do we situate these different things in terms of priorities. So after deconstruction, how do I go and reconstruct my Mormon faith in a way that gives me meaning in staying involved in it? For me, I frame Mormonism in terms of at least. So God is at least a projection of our best desires. Satan is at least a projection of our worst flaws. Atonement is at least our ability to heal ourselves and our environments. Jesus is at least someone who tapped into the power of atonement and God to overcome Satan, and that this work is the work of Christ. The restoration is at least a continuous process to recover and reconcile religious ideas to better align with God and Christ. Then, on that rather modest ground, I construct things I have faith in, hope for, or feel are true. Notice how I'm kind of adapting one story or one myth or one perspective into another one in this deconstruction and reconstruction process. I really believe that science should inform and challenge our stories and myths, but ultimately I also believe, this is where the post-secular side comes in, that science is unable to create new ones that approach the real moral questions of life, that we need both. And so some of my answers here might feel are very influenced by my participation and affinity with the Mormon Transhumanist Association. But bear with me a bit. It comes around on what this can mean for staying engaged and inviting more in. I believe that the universe or universes with all its diversity has been around long enough for intelligence to emerge within our deep past, perhaps transcending morality or mortality, and that the power involved in doing so requires a society that's benevolent enough not to destroy itself with that power. I believe that in a potentially infinite emergent universe, what makes eternity worth living for gods is discovering and connecting with infinitely novel, co-eternal, co-emergent intelligence, while avoiding their engagement, squelching that emergent intelligence's novelty. And I believe that this will cause gods to engage in creative endeavors, even to extremes like preserving and resurrecting the novelty and diversity of intelligences, so gods can continue to commune with them and foster their growth, ultimately becoming peers and joining with them in that work. And here's a very Mormon flair at the end here, is I believe that the only way for us to prove this is for us to work to become these gods ourselves. So the end result here in this reconstruction process feels so much sturdier for me in our post-secular age, and so much more beautiful and very Mormon. It has another effect where it can welcome theists, agnostics, and even atheists alike. It almost becomes a matter of whether we see God in our past, present, or future. Personally, I land in the theist camp, seeing God in our environment, but also acknowledge that perhaps God is humanity's potential, not our heritage. So from a secular perspective, and I've had these conversations, I work in an engineering field with other engineers, that show me the best possible scientific, engineering, and social trajectories, and I will point out how those outline God, or at least a vision of God that's worthy of emulation. So given the broad and persistent challenge that Christianity and US and other countries is facing with declining rates and tensions and so forth, I wonder whether minor policy or theological tweaks can even reverse that trend. So rather than cater to some of the classical assumptions that go on with theism and religion, I wonder sometimes perhaps if Mormonism has within it the ability to call to and invite some of these disengaged groups. How might religious decline be affected by theology that challenges norms and crosses the boundaries that religion, much of religion, has rested itself with? So I feel these early Mormon germ truths are so powerful that I want to stay and help them develop and find new expression. That's something in particular that I find an outlet in that the Mormon Transhumanist Association. So very it itches that layer of Mormonism for me. So I ran across this quote years ago, and I just wanted to share it here because I find it to be a very prophetic statement said by B.H. Roberts over 100 years ago. He said, "Mormonism calls for thoughtful disciples who will not be content merely with repeating some of its truths, but will develop its truths and enlarge it by that development. The prophet planted by teaching the germ truths of the great dispensation, the fullness of times, the watering and weeding is going on, and God is giving the increase and will give it more abundantly in the future as more intelligent discipleship shall obtain. The disciples of Mormonism, growing discontented with the necessarily primitive methods which have hitherto prevailed in sustaining the doctrine, will yet take profounder and broader views of the great doctrines committed to the church and, departing from mere repetition, will cast them in new formulas, cooperating in the works of the Spirit until they help to give the truth received a more forceful expression and carry it beyond earlier and cruder stages of development." So what I explained before of this almost kind of post-secular reframing, I view as one way or one formula that Mormonism could be recast into. I think there are other formulas. Farina, you know, mentioned some great wisdom in how she identifies. And so I just wanted to end here with talking about this top layer just briefly in how do I, what are the reasons I stay in the LDS church? For here, the answer is very much built in my personal experiences. And so I'll end with a personal experience going back to this experience I had in the hospital with my aunt. So we were sitting in this tension, both of us secure on opposing sides and debates and doctrines of salvation. And what it struck us was what we were doing in the midst of this disagreement. We were encouraging my mother to fight, to try breathing for just a little bit longer on her own. We were working with doctors, nurses, administering oil to soothe both religious and medicinal to soothe her body. Being there, she woke from anesthesia, from major surgery, massaging her legs as she needed to feel comfort, and helping her feel safe in the chaos of another patient in the ICU who was coming off of a hard drug overdose. So these, in this sacred work of ministering to one another and serving one another in our pain, these heated doctrinal divides often don't matter very much. I've challenged my children to memorize a poem, a very short poem by Adam Lindsay Gordon. He says, "Life is mostly froth and bubble. Two things stand like stone, courage in another's trouble, kindness in another's trouble, courage in your own." I think that the doctrinal certainties that we often get mired in questions of why stay are actually the froth in the bubble in the ocean of faith. And while they can serve a purpose, they aren't very good at addressing the specific intimate evils and pains that we all grapple with. Going back to this hymn, I think Jesus calls us to holier spheres here when we want to ask ourselves questions of why stay. For me, I don't cast those as much in terms of doctrine. I look at it as, you know, I love Mormonism's soaring doctrines of salvation and things that resonate with me in a post-secular context. But I stay in the LDS Church not because I see it as the source of all light and knowledge of God, truth, and morality. I think our articles of faith say that it's not that. Not because it's the source of salvation for all. I think Christ, we need to center Christ there. But because it simply provides an environment in which I'm able to practice embodying Jesus's call to follow him and to build his kingdom on earth in a Mormon context. My hope, and this is part of the reason I my wife and I have done things like create a LGBTQFHE working with our stake, is I think we have a lot of potential to invite more onto this ground, not centered on dogmas and doctrines and proclamations, but really centered on some of these core germ truths of reconciliation and atonement, becoming like God, and inviting others along in that journey. So I just wanted to thank, again, the opportunity to share some thoughts.
Thank you, Caleb. As a reminder, hold on, I'm gonna get Julie prepped here. As a reminder, submit your questions on the WHO app. Be specific about who you want to answer them. We've gotten permission from the organizers to go a little long today because we're getting a lot of good questions. And so if you can stick with us past the 3 o'clock time period, we are going to go past that to be able to have some good discussion here. So take it away, Julie.
Thanks, Bob. And thank you, Farina and Caleb, for your fascinating and inspiring talks. And thank you all 188 of you for spending time with us today. This was a really interesting exercise, and I took it as a writing exercise, and it's hard to pack in why I stay into 20 minutes, but I've tried to be as concise as possible. So why do I stay? Only 2 out of 9 children in my family of origin are still active in the church, and I'm regularly asked by family, friends, and random people on the internet, why do you stay? I also ask myself this question often. The older I get, the less I know, the more uncertain I become, and the more questions I have. Here are some song lyrics that describe this uncertainty. I know how to throw a tantrum and a stone, how to be a martyr and be alone, how to change my mind and change my tune. I know how to burn a candle at both ends, how to burn my finger and burn a bridge, how to bend an ear and bend the rules. But I don't know what I don't know. I know I don't know enough, how to make the pieces fit, how to make some sense of this. I don't know what I don't know. I know I don't know enough. Fill me with light and love. Poet and novelist Rainer Maria Rilke has said, have patience with everything that remains unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a foreign language. Do not now look for the answers. They cannot now be given to you because you could not live them. It is a question of experiencing everything. At present, you need to live the question. Perhaps you will gradually, without even noticing it, find yourself experiencing the answer some distant day. So why do I stay in the church? I stay because some of my deepest questions require me to stay in the church in order to experience the answer. Question 1, can an active Latter-day Saint woman be a dedicated wife and mother and have a thriving professional and creative life? My family of origin was a traditional patriarchal LDS family. My father was the breadwinner and the bishop. My mom stayed home and raised 9 children. I had very little exposure to women who had a family and pursued education or careers. Over the pulpit, I was hearing that God wanted me to be a wife and mother. In junior high, I struggled with perfectionism, some difficult family dynamics, some depression and eating problems. My parents asked me if I wanted to see a therapist, and therapy was the beginning of exploring a rich inner life with deep and complex emotions and thoughts. It helped me to develop an awareness of human motivation, unconscious processes, and relational dynamics. I started developing a sense of self through therapy that was separate from my family. Therapy also planted in me a deep desire to help others change their lives in some way, as therapy had helped me. In addition to therapy, I started writing songs in adolescence, and songwriting became a way to heal emotions and make sense of life and relationships and my faith journey. Because my dad, a composer and musician, had been writing inspirational songs, you may have heard some of them, like, "Who are these children coming down?" It seemed really natural for me to do the same, so I started writing. I graduated from North Hollywood High School and started college in 1987, the year President Ezra Taft Benson gave his landmark talk to the mothers in Zion, urging mothers to stay home full-time with their children. He said, "The counsel of the church has always been for mothers to spend full-time in the home in rearing and caring for their children." He also said numerous divorces can be traced directly to the day when the wife left the home and went into the world of employment. This same year of the talk, I was recording my first album of original songs. It was actually a cassette. I started my college career with dreams of becoming a therapist, and I wanted to marry and have a family. I felt in my heart like my heavenly parents wanted all of those things for me. The prophet was telling me something different than my personal revelation. This was a decision point. I recall saying to myself as a young adult, "No one else is going to answer for my life, my gifts, my talents, and my life's missions, not even the prophet. This is my life." As a young adult, I claimed my personal authority and began learning about the interplay and the tension between general and personal revelation. While in some ways I've lived an expected Mormon life, I got married at 20 years old to Jeff Hanks, way too young, but a good choice nevertheless, and had my first of four children by age 21. I was also fiercely committed to my personal growth and creative, educational, and professional development. My husband and I have developed a partnership relationship where we share the burdens and responsibilities of leading, providing, and nurturing our family. So far, it has allowed both of us to pursue our family and our professional goals. Can an active Latter-day Saint woman be a dedicated wife, mother, and have a thriving professional and creative life? I think so. I'm still living the question. Question two, can women become equal to men in the church? As I entered young adulthood, gender disparities became increasingly obvious at church. The male side of the church is very organized as Heavenly Father, Jesus, 12 apostles, Quorum of 70s, on down the line. Priesthood offices and duties were set forth, yet on the feminine side, there was a void. We had Heavenly Mother, of whom we rarely speak, and there are very few titles, duties, and responsibilities and authority outlined on the feminine side. Women are often defined by their relationship to a man. I'm currently defined as the bishop's wife. Most of my therapy practice and online content and advocacy is geared toward empowering women in the church and reframing LDS cultural norms. I'm hoping to play a part in moving the culture toward emotional health and equality for women. While I'm heartened by the recent changes, the temple wording changes, Relief Society and Elders Quorum being equalized on a ward level, the addition to women on top councils of the church, women witnessing ordinances, more talk of women's use of priesthood power, there is still a lot of work to be done. I believe and hope there's more to be restored in regard to feminine power and authority. What does it mean to be a priestess? Where are the prophetesses? I love the doctrine of Heavenly Mother. It gives me hope for equality here on earth. As we bring her forth, maybe women in the church can take their place next to men, side by side, in partnership. I long to have more information about my divine role model and to have a glimpse into my eternal stewardships and potential. I believe that bringing Heavenly Mother to our consciousness will work to elevate all women to a place of equality in the church. To know my power and my possibilities, what my possibilities are in the eternities. I recently have been seeking to know more earnestly the feminine divine. And here's a song lyric about my desire. Mother, where art thou? I have read the ancient words, searching for your name, tracing every line on every page, imagining your face. I hear echoes of your voice in the stillness of the night as I strain to see your shadow in the stories of so long ago. Are you the binding on each page? Are you the thread that ties all humankind through every age? Are you the spaces in between, above, around, beneath? Come out from your cloud. Mother, where art thou? Were you there when it began, in the garden near the tree, the architect of Eden's door for Eve and all humanity? Are you the cradle and the grave? Are you the hand that lifts all living things to higher ways? Are you the soil and the waves, the blossom and the rays? Come out from your shroud. Mother, where art thou? Your weary daughter's kneeling. We're praying and we're pleading that you can stop this bleeding. The world has lost its feeling. How we need your healing. We long for your revealing. How we need a mother now. Mother, where art thou? Can women become equal to men in the church? I hope so. I'm still living that question. Question 3, can the church help me become like Christ? While going to Mormon church on Sunday, I attended an evangelical Christian school in Southern California during most of my elementary school. Though I was occasionally told I was going to hell because I was Mormon, attending this school helped me to gain a deep appreciation for the New Testament. We had daily Bible study and weekly chapel services. The focus on the life and teachings of Jesus touched my tender heart and resonated as good, as true. And even though I was baptized in the LDS church and had already taken his name upon myself, at school I did ask Jesus into my heart during altar calls just to cover my bases. As I continued activity in the Mormon church, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, along with scripture study and prayer, my desire to want to be more Christ-like has grown. I'm not even certain whether he was real or not, but my life is better for trying to be like him. I started doing firesides for youth groups in late adolescence, and as a young mother in my early 20s, juggling performing, school, marriage, and parenthood, I had just finished giving a youth fireside. To say that it didn't go well is an understatement. The youth were restless, talking, not paying attention, and disengaged. My words and my songs didn't reach them at all. I wondered why I was putting myself out there. I wondered what was wrong. I prayed to know what went wrong, why the fireside was a disaster for both me and the youth. And I got my answer through a song. I want to be a window to his love, so when you look at me, you will see him. I want to be so pure and clear that you won't even know I'm here, because his love will shine brightly through me. I want to be a doorway to the truth, so when you walk beyond, you will find him. I want to stand so straight and tall that you won't notice me at all, but through my open door, he will be seen. A window to his love, a doorway to the truth, a bearer of the message he'd have me bring to you. And with each passing day, I want to fade away until only he can be seen and I become a window to his love. That song taught me that the problem with the fireside was that I needed it to be less about me and more about Christ. As my own family has grown over the past 31 years, we've continued our involvement in the church. The lessons of daily family life have created endless opportunities to practice being Christ-like. It's in family life that weaknesses are exposed and edges are softened. It's in family life where forgiveness, mercy, grace, tolerance, meekness, and patience, and every other Christ-like quality is regularly practiced over and over and over again. The church has been and continues to be a large part of our family heritage and our collective life experiences. I have a daughter who went through a period of rebellion as a teenager and decided to leave the church. Ironically, her leaving was one of the biggest growth opportunities of my life. Going through the process of having a child leave has helped me to become more Christ-like. I learned to let go. I learned to trust my heavenly parents to take care of her. I learned to celebrate her agency. Most importantly, I learned a little bit about what it means to love unconditionally, as our heavenly parents do. The practices and rituals of the church, prayer, scripture study, temple attendance, helped me tremendously in this process. Can the church help me become more Christ-like? I hope so. I'm still living the question. Question 4, can we create Zion in our community? This is my community. The Mormon faith tradition is my tradition, so why not try to enhance the tradition that I've been given? I've tried to help heal our community through songs, speaking, mentoring women, providing therapy and relationship counseling to hundreds of Latter-day Saints by pushing against unhealthy cultural norms through blogging and social media. The church community offers a place and the rituals to practice the two great commandments, love God and love his children. Following these commandments will lead us toward Zion. I don't know if I would regularly be practicing these two commandments without the structure of the church. I think it's possible to practice these two great commandments, but I'm kind of lazy and I often take the path of least resistance. Everything about the gospel points to the importance of relationships, earthly and heavenly. There's creative power in coming together in our community. In my experience, revelation often comes through relationships, through councils, through bumping up against each other and doing our best to stumble forward. An important part of creating Zion in our community is making it safer for those at the margins, at the edge of the flock. The only way I feel I can make the church a safer place for others is to stay in the church. I want to be part of that change. I want everyone to feel welcome. Those with doubts about doctrine and policy and history, women, people of color, LGBTQ brothers and sisters. In the Book of Mormon, after the visitation of Christ, the people are said to have experienced periods of peace. This is my hope and my vision of what we can create as a community. And the people were all converted unto the Lord, and there were no contentions and disputations among them. And every man did deal justly one with another, and they had all things common among them. Therefore, there were not rich or poor, bond or free, but they were all made free and partakers of the heavenly gift. Surely there could not be a happier people among all the people who had been created by the hand of God. They were in one, the children of Christ and heirs to the kingdom of God. Can we create Zion in our community? I hope so. I'm still living the question. Question 5. Can I stay and hold all of the light and shadow, the known and the mystery, the faith and doubt that comes with belonging to this church? I am aware of the problems with the historicity of the Book of Mormon, the authenticity of the Book of Abraham, the multiple accounts of the first vision, Joseph Smith marrying a 14-year-old, practicing polygamy behind Emma's back, that the church denied the priesthood to blacks. I know the church causes pain. I've heard that pain expressed for decades in my therapy office. I know the church has investments somewhere near $100 billion. I know about the sex abuse scandals. So why do I stay? I stay because alongside the problems and the pain, I've experienced the mysteries of God. I've had answers to prayers through the practices of this church. I've developed increased compassion toward others as I've had the opportunity to serve. I've seen the church transform lives through meaningful teachings, practices, and rituals. I've felt the beauty of belonging to this community. I stay because it makes me a better person. I stay because I believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the imperfect vehicle I have chosen to get me to the destination of becoming more like Christ. The church has light and dark, good and bad, joy and pain, and everything in between. Staying in the church has taught me how to hold paradox and hold ambiguity. Ultimately, my life is better because I stay. Offering. In my hand, I hold a penny, tarnished and so small. I know it's a meager offering, but it is my all. In return, you build me mansions, palaces, and thrones. I'm offering a piece of rusty copper. You're offering streets of gold. In my hand, a bead of water, salty, frail teardrop. I know it's a meager offering, but it's all I've got. In return, you send me oceans. Downpour feeds the flood. I'm offering a tiny fallen droplet. You're drenching me with love. In my hand, a blackened stone, cold, hard heap of coal. I know it's a meager offering, but it is my soul. In return, you drape me in diamonds, gems so rare and round. I'm offering a roughened rock, unpolished. You're fitting me a crown. In my hand, I hold a candle, tiny, fragile spark. I know it's a meager offering, but it is my heart. In return, your summer sunshine, winter is undone. I'm offering a flicker in the darkness. You're offering the sun. You're offering the sun. Can I hold all the light and shadow, the known and the mystery, faith and the doubt that comes from being in this church? I hope so. I'm still living the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Okay. I'm going to get everybody back in here to the room together. So let's see if we can't get everybody all in. Here we are, almost. Where's Caleb? There he is. First of all, you know, you can't see everybody, but, you know, Zoom is telling us we have about 183 people on right now. If this were a fireside, we'd be super excited at that number of people here. So just imagine them sitting in front of you while I ask you these questions. We've got some good questions. And as a reminder to those of you who are watching, submit questions in the Whova app. There's also a cool feature in there where you can like someone else's question. And if it's a question similar to one that you would ask, you can just upvote those and they'll sort of rise up to the top. And we are, this session was slated to go until 3 p.m. Mountain Time. We've gotten permission to go a little bit longer. So as long as the presenters can stay, we're going to just dive into some questions. Let's just agree right now between all of us that this can be a discussion. So unless I direct something directly to a specific person, you guys can talk to each other and have a little dialogue about the questions. Don't feel weird about that. Okay, let me just start with a general question for everybody. How do you navigate a nuanced view when bringing children to church and participating in activities where they will be constantly taught things that you don't agree with? Racism, patriarchy, especially focus on girls' looks and dress code. That's a good question. Who wants to start?
I know we started some conversation there. For me, I mean, it's not, how do I say it? Life is so integral, right? So as someone who's identifies as Native American, a Native American Diné woman, I face and see what my friends of all diverse backgrounds who are marginalized, you know, Blacks, Asian, or wherever people are coming from, that there's always these forces of divisiveness and hatred in different contexts there, in different environments. So how I see that then is I prepare my children every day talking to them first, you know, by trying to be a good example myself, recognizing that I'm going to make mistakes, that I'm going to do the best to be humble of learning, that I am excited to pursue the path of trying to learn about other people and learn where they're coming from, because, you know, we're all born in different situations. We're all coming from a different lens and positionality. And especially as an educator, you know, that's what I face all the time with the students. I don't pick the students in my classroom. It's like, we don't pick who's in our realm. And especially in church, you don't get to pick who's in your congregation, right? Maybe some people, now that gets messy, right, on geography of where you're living. But I try to prepare my children always to focus on important truths of how we relate socially, and to also not be afraid to speak up and stand up for when they see something going too far. I like, for example, what Caleb said about boundaries is, but what I found in particular is to prepare ourselves, learn more about how to do that, because when we come in the moment of, say, you're someone's at the pulpit and they're starting to say something, do you run up there and, you know, take them down? Or what will that do? You know, what are the ramifications of the actions we take? So with my children, I try to talk to them and teach them in home and by example about, you know, how we should be treating and prepare them as well, that it could be their teachers, it could be whoever, who might be saying something coming from somewhere else, who learned something else in their homes of what's acceptable and what's not. And especially as a historian, right, like we live in structures that were, we've been born into structures that were inherently racist. We're inheriting legacies of racism, not just in the church, but maybe folks are chiming in from all over the world. But in my specific context in the United States, I'm living in a place where there's been an ongoing effort to exterminate my people, Dene people, of my father's people, you know? And I've had to prepare my children for that and talk to them about that at a very young age, because they're being fed myths, not just at church, but in school and in different places. So it's something in the home and conversations. We have check-ins regularly about what are you learning? What's going on? And I share with them the experiences that I still face with even, people who are well-educated and have PhDs, and they're still saying racist crap to me and about Native people, right? And so we're all still learning, and I'm trying to teach how do we address this without making it explode or worse, you know? And it's not that I'm saying it's automatically going to be worse, but these can be very delicate situations and complicated. And how can we best prepare? For me, the best piece of advice, or from my experience that I'm still learning because it's not easy, is how can I do things and approach things in love and kindness and teach my children that? But that doesn't mean you're a doormat, or that, you know, you let other people bully others around or push them down. But there's a way to go about it with love first. And that's something I'm still figuring out too, because I like to stand up and call people out. That's me.
I might just say something real quick. The one thing that we do with our children is, and their ages range from 15 all the way to 5, and is we normalize flaws, that flawed institutions, flawed doctrines, flawed policies, flawed people, flawed parents, that's all we have, right? And so we teach them to expect that, not to, you know, amplify the flaws, or not to, you know, go around constantly nitpicking and trying to, you know, try to get all of the, you know, flaws out, and like, you know, what Farina was mentioning, to call people out all the time, but to just empower them that you're going to see these flaws, and that that's not the end of the world, because you don't have to accept falsities, right? All you have to accept is truth. And sometimes that's going to require some digging. That's going to require some thinking things through differently than what you might be hearing from various sources. But then to balance that with trying to model amplifying the good people that you have in the ward, the good teachings that the church does have. And so it's a balancing, I would say, between those two.
Yeah, I would just add that helping your kids recognize truth, recognize what resonates with them, and to help them develop that ability to kind of yeah, that doesn't feel right, or that feels right to me. So we have a lot of conversations about that with my kids. Does that feel true to you? Because not everything that you're going to hear at church or school or anywhere is going to be true. So helping them figure that out, how to navigate that themselves.
I really appreciate that statement, because even with our own children, right, I experienced with my family that lately there's been a lot of conversation about mascots, Native Americans as mascots. And my kids have heard me, I mean, I write op-eds about this, or I'm like talking about it, having a panel about it or something. And they're listening, you know, that's the most powerful thing too. That's what I mean by they're watching you and they're learning a lot from you. And one, you know, depending on what age, I don't know what age or whatever, but a lot of children, they are sponges, right? And they're just absorbing. And even with me, with my life, I recognize how much I absorb from my parents. But then there's times where even from a young age, I contested things. I challenged my parents, you know, the generational differences and whatnot. But that is introducing them to terms that they're working through, right? And so if you're participating in this church and it matters of what is seen as normal, or how are they viewing what is flaw, or what, when they start to ask questions and face for themselves, because I found with the mascots, for example, my kids started to ask, like they'd see something like a team called the Warriors and they'd say, "Mom, is that racist?" And then we'd enter a conversation. You know, they wanted an answer from me. Sometimes, you know, we want it simple. Give me the yes or no. But it's a lot about the process and the experience of having a conversation. And that's what I find even in those moments in church, when I hear they heard something at church, or I'm sitting in a lesson and I hear something, and especially my husband too, like things that really rub him the wrong way. And he just wants to call out and be like, "No way." But teaching them too, that this is a process of we're learning, you're hearing from me, I'm sharing from you my perspectives, my interpretations. So more than just like saying everybody flaws, makes errors and mistakes, we're learning and we're trying to process in our own terms and what we're going through. And there's not always going to be a pretty tie a bow on it. It's yes or no, bad or good. Even if, you know, we are seeking that truth of what is right, you know, choose the right. What is that right? And I think that's where that personal revelation and teaching them what will guide them is so important. What's going to be their compass? Where are they going to turn to seek those a complicated answer? And I think that's something we belittle ourselves by. We are complicated beings. This is something as a historian I see, like understanding people, we are very complicated, and that's beautiful. You don't have to freak out that it's not black or white, you know, one way or the other. We are able to be on this high intellectual level, and I appreciate that being shared from the other panelists too, like Julie and Caleb. Thank you.
I got a question that's directed for Julie. This is a good question. You talked about hoping Heavenly Mother becomes a part of our common lexicon. While I'd also enjoy bringing more of the divine feminine, I feel it would be dangerous to have our current male leadership define her for us. She'd be the perfect heavenly homemaker. Do you see women ever taking ownership of the doctrine of a mother God figure?
My hope, my dream would be to have the Relief Society be empower themselves to be prophetesses and to receive that revelation. I know that's like... Who knows if that's going to happen, but that would be my hope. I do know, just from talking with women are rising up and saying, "We want to know her." So there's a lot of grassroots movements going on, reclaiming the feminine divine. So I do think it has to come ultimately from women and defining what that, who Heavenly Mother is, and receiving that revelation.
A question for everyone. This has the most votes of all the questions here, so that's why I'm asking you. Do you stay in LDS because, one, it's your birth tradition? Two, it's the largest Mormon tradition and has broad reach. Three, it's true or more true than other Mormon traditions. Or four, some other reason. So, Caleb, you start.
Yeah, and I think I replied to that, but I'll just touch on a couple points. And I think it's a lot of number one and number two for me. As far as truth claims, I've gone through enough deconstruction and reconstruction that doesn't really, I don't hang a lot of the load-bearing questions of life on truth claims. I think we can have discussions about, truths that are taught that are positive or perhaps in certain ways unique to LDS and Mormon traditions. But for me, I do have to admit that I think, this is part of the answer is also I'm born into a heritage. It's part of who I am. It's my DNA, really. But the deconstruction reconstruction process also makes it a choice, a conscious choice, an ongoing choice. And I also do, I say number two also because I do value community. I look at Christ and Christian ethics really as being relational ethics. And so I don't even know how to practice my Mormonism or my Christianity outside of a community. And so that does also gravitate me towards a bit the LDS tradition because, it is imperfect community notwithstanding. And this is even deeply personal because within my own family, within my own family, my son doesn't see value in the community and in ways I do. And so community is just messy. And so I think we can see value in it while also acknowledging the fact that others may not at the same time.
Anybody else?
One and two for me as well. I don't believe that it's more true. I think there's a lot of truth. I think we have certain doctrines that are unique that I value. And then there are lots of other reasons, as I talked about in my talk.
Okay. Farina, do you want to address this one?
So I know, like, being asked to participate in this group, why I stay, you want a clean answer. you just want, boom, this is the key. This is why it is. But I can't say it's any one of those, and even if I said it's a facet or it's a piece of every one of them, actually, though I agree with the wording about truer than other things or whatever, that also, like I said, with the kind of questions we ask, they have implications with them or certain meanings that link, latch onto them. And so that, for me, I pick up on the worry here of what happens is, it turns into this hierarchy of, and we do hear this, right, by certain church members of this is the true church and all others are bad. And that even, has hurt people very personally in my family and home. Like, for example, I have an aunt who had been through a lot of hardship in her life, and she found Jesus, really found a faith that gave her purpose and really turned around her life, and beautiful. Like, she was headed maybe somewhere dark in her life of depression and hardship, and she found something beautiful in her life. And she talked to a Latter-day Saint who said, she told him, I found Jesus. He was a friend of hers from high school. And he said, well, you're not in our church, so you're still screwed. He basically said that to her. And, she's an aunt out of state. I don't see her much. And she shared that with me of how that really was sour and painful for her. And for me, it hurt. It hurt me. That, you know, it's just like, how dare you? How dare somebody say that to my aunt? Anyway, yeah, this is a personal question. And even these questions, they spark a lot. I think for me, it's a complicated web that you have to trace my life, right? I was a child of two converts who met at BYU, who had eight children, and a lot of people already were against their relationship. My dad went to BYU at a time when they were told, he was told at a time, you shouldn't date any white woman. You're not supposed to. And, you know, not long before he did start to date my mother on a blind date, because she happened to be open-minded and roomed with other Native American women who were friends with my father there, at a time when BYU actually had one of the largest Native American student populations in the country that most people don't know. So very complicated and interesting past with Native Americans too there. And for my father, yeah, you know, he does believe he is a Lamanite and has talked about that, you know, what that means to him, that it's like a truth, you know, that he's related to. And people have asked me, do you believe that? You know, and now all this research coming up, DNA, I saw it in this conference, you know, the program and such. But there's folks who are empowered by these teachings. And yes, you know, of the eight children, there's some of my siblings who have left the church. Some of my siblings, you know, who are living in such a way that maybe I can't say why they left. It's like we don't talk about it either. You know, it's taboo to talk about. So that's why I'm grateful we're having these conversations at all, because you can't point to one answer. It, like I said, it's complicated, and I'm not trying to say that to get off of it. We need to have these conversations. I'm glad, you know, you're pushing the envelope here, you know, and having us start to address it, right? And for me, yeah, you know, I can say I wouldn't have known the church if my parents didn't raise us in the church. But I know, like, some of my siblings left, and I can guess on reasons, but that's something very internal. And for me, there's experiences here that I don't feel it's appropriate. I'm being recorded. You know, I probably would feel more appropriate at a pulpit, you know, a testimony meeting, sharing that than here. I'm going to be honest about, because for me, I even was hush-hush that I am Latter-day Saint, because there still is. And especially being Latter-day Saint and Native American, identifying as Native American, people think you cannot be that. And that there's been, you know, personal attacks, or the way they judge you or treat you different, especially as a professional, a person who I try to engage with public conversations and such. And that's sad, you know, that I realize I shouldn't have to be afraid of that anymore. You know, this is what I believe. And there are experiences that are dear and personal to me about why I stay. And I might get to know you and share that more with you. But this is about trust as well, right? Because there's some things in my life that if I share with people, they're just going to think I'm crazy. And they think I'm crazy already. For some people who think I'm crazy already for being in these kind of conversations and talking about it. So it's just called embracing your weirdness, embracing who you are, and an amazing neighbor, not a member of the church, right? Like in Maryland, when I was living there, lived through the bombing on England during World War II. She told me one of the best pieces of advice that I've heard here and there in other renditions is just be yourself, because that's what you're best at. So we all have, as I wrote in the Q&A, one of the responses, we have gifts and talents and potential and strengths. And for me, I love what's said here is like, we all can be broken vessels in ways, but I found I'm able to heal through these communities that I have connections to, and being a part of a Latter-day Saint community and a member of the Church of Jesus Christ has empowered me to heal in the ways I need to right now in my life. I can't see the future. I don't know what's going on, but I have faith you know, faith that, that it will be okay, it will be beautiful. And I'm taught things that families can be together forever. And that's what I really care about, even when, you know, with our own families, we have a lot of personal stuff. You don't always get along with your family, right? So, you know, if that's something you don't want to put your dirty laundry out there, but it's a human experience too, that you don't always agree with even those you love and who are the closest to you. And why is that? But that's a beauty of it. We are meant to be different. We are meant to like learn from each other and grow from each other. And that's something that I find, like, we are moving contradictions, but where do we still, how do we still have that balance enough to walk with the gravity pushing us down? And then, you know, learning to fly, that we do have that potential of really soaring and being the best us that we can be. And that's what I find right now in my life and my path, and that I'm still learning. I'm still learning. And I appreciate that journey and having it with you. And thank you, you know, for entering these conversations with us.
So we're going to do one more question. And it's directed at Julie in the comments, but I think all of us could answer it. All of you guys could answer it. Before I ask the question, you know, Caleb, you mentioned just a second ago that you'd responded to a question in the app. And I would invite all the presenters to go, after our session is over, go to the app. There are some questions that are directed to each of you. There are some for all of you there. And just take a second and answer them. There's some really good ones there. So this one was directed to Julie, but I think it works for all of us. How carefully do you weigh how much or how little you push back on a church policy or announcement? We're talking about policies or announcements that are troubling to us. Talk us through that. So this is a good question. Let's end on this question. We'll have Julie start, and then you guys can chime in if you'd like.
Well, I do a lot of pushing back online, blogging, writing about things, posting. So it never helps to make personal attacks people get defensive, right? So I try to share my feelings, share my disappointment about the whatever the issue is, but not attack the people, because I just think that's counterproductive. So that's one of the ways I push back.
Don't attack the people. Are you talking about like the church leaders themselves?
The church leaders, right? Once you do that, you cut off a lot of people from hearing what you have to say. That's what I've found.
That's good advice. Have you, either of you others, had experience with this? How to push back, how to know when to push back?
I wouldn't always see it as pushback as much as, you know, exactly. It's that point of framing of like, I'm trying to help, you know? Like, that's how I've seen it in a recent situation where, I mean, I'll just be honest about this because you can Google it if you want. But BYU, for example, I'm an alumna. I'm a Native American alumna at BYU. BYU, a church run school, you know, so close affiliation there, but it's not the church, has an interesting relationship, right? It is a university, but has all these ties to the church. And they recently formed the committee on addressing race and inequality issues. And I saw the committee and I noticed that they didn't have a Native American representative. And, you know, people will say it opens the bag of Pandora's box, the bag of worms, can of worms, whatever, of everybody's going to want their representative, blah, blah, blah. But I had to explain and educate from my perspective that BYU and even Brigham Young, the namesake of it, the school itself, had intricate relationships with Native Americans. The university and the church, the headquarters, it's founded on Native American lands, and understanding the history of that and how complicated that is, of us colonialism and settler, you know, removal, the removal of indigenous peoples, and where there's still like ongoing, you know, tension. So I'm, as an educator, trying to help by teaching, this is why this matters. let's, you know, reevaluate this. There are qualified individuals who are willing to serve on that committee who are Native American. So I started to see it as opening a conversation, not that I'm like trying to say, oh, down with them. They're, you know, like, as Julie said, being careful not to personally attack, or, you know, just being careful about the approach of saying, I'm trying to share input here, and also connecting with others in a healthy way, realizing that there were other movements coalescing, such as the Black Student Union and the open letter from Deborah Alexis, who said, that had recommendations for BYU addressing a difficult past of, overcoming racism, institutional racism in the past and the legacies of that. And so connecting with individuals who were spearheading these movements, change.org, of people who, aren't trying to criticize or like see it as taking down anybody, but more we're trying to be constructive. It's like, are you trying to be constructive and heal and help? What's your intention? Where is your heart? Like, where's that heading? And for me, that's where I've realized where I'm going to enter or not, because I'm a human being. I have resentment. You know, I can carry resentment. I can have those personal feelings that I believe are the adversary's happy we have, you know, like that's him pushing us, and we're all going to be facing, right, as the Cherokee say, the two wolves of us. Do you feed that dark wolf or the light wolf? And the way that you approach this, be sure it's in a positive motion of being constructive and supportive. So that's what I found in my experience.
Caleb, we'll give you the last word on this question. You'll be our last thing, so make it really good.
Make it really good, right.
No pressure.
So, yeah, and I agree with both what, Julie and Farina have been saying, and I think we have to think also, I talk about sometimes with our children and others of what does sustaining mean? And sustaining doesn't mean ideological surrender, right? And there's pretty strong language from Joseph Smith talking about how he does not like creeds and he doesn't want to be trammeled by doctrine and things like that. And so our modern kind of creeds that have emerged notwithstanding, I think it's a very deeply Mormon tradition to resist creeds and static notions of faith. And so I think also part of it is we sometimes overinflate policy. And I don't want to say that to not recognize that policy can have real harm. But I even go back to things like temple recommend questions. I don't see anything in a temple recommend question that's committing me to assenting to current, specific interpretations. Those are pretty broad questions. And so when I go into something like a temple recommend interview, I look at it as they're grading the bubble sheet, not my work. And so going back to the question of, do you push back and things, I tend to take more of a educational kind of role. I want to gather a lot of resources for people, help share those resources with people to help them understand it's not just all or nothing, right? There's nuance involved here. And I think if we can bring that nuance up in community, in our wards, in our stakes, in a way that is, Farina's mentioned, that's doesn't undermine trust and doesn't come across as I'm personally attacking someone, that we can help open hearts and open minds and do so in an inviting way.
Well, Farina, Caleb, Julie, thank you so much for your time and for your words today. And thank you all of you out there and wherever you may be for sticking with us and being a part of this session. We hope you'll continue to join us this weekend and next year. So thank you. Let's all wave goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.